Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest edition of the Oxford Energy Podcast. My name is James Henderson. I'm a director of the gas program at OIS, and I'm here today with Alex Barnes, who's a senior visiting research fellow at OIS, to talk about his latest paper, The Challenges and Prospects for Carbon Pricing in Europe, which was published about a week ago. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Jim. Good to be here.
Great. Well, look, let's get into the detail on this. What is this very, very, very important topic? But perhaps we can start at a sort of higher level. What do you actually mean by carbon pricing? Why is it so important? And perhaps you could explain the difference for us between carbon pricing and the ETS, perhaps, and carbon taxation.
Sure. Okay. Well, the reason that carbon pricing is so important is it's because it's trying to put a price on emissions of greenhouse gas emissions. The biggest one of these is carbon dioxide, hence carbon pricing. So it's actually pricing carbon dioxide emissions rather than carbon itself. And also it can potentially include other greenhouse emissions like methane, for example. In terms of the way of pricing carbon, there are two main mechanisms. One is setting a direct carbon price as part of a carbon tax. And in that system, a government might say, right, for every ton of CO2 that gets emitted, a company has to pay a particular price. And the aim is that they set the price at a high enough level to incentivize companies to reduce emissions. The other way is a so-called emissions trading system, where you don't set the price directly, but you say that companies have to have allowances in order to emit CO2, for example. And then the amount of allowances that companies are able to access, for example, buying by auction or being allocated by the government, reduce over time, and they can trade these allowances between them, which sets the price, and that also should aim for emissions reduction. The advantage of that approach is that companies which have very low costs for reducing emissions can sell their surplus allowances to companies that have got higher costs of reducing emissions, but overall emissions come down. And the price of that allowance will sort of make you decide whether or not it's cheaper to buy allowances from somebody in the market or whether you reduce emissions yourself. But they both aim at the same thing, namely reducing emissions.
And in your paper, I think you highlight that particularly in the EU, there's an element of mix and match between the two, with governments and the EU sort of opting for various options which they put together. But perhaps we'll get to that in a sec. But I mean, the general concept is that this has become more important because of the net zero targets that have been starting to be set and therefore getting companies to move in that direction.
Absolutely. And I think what will also happen is that because that implies a higher carbon price, it's going to become more politically sensitive. So there is a carbon price already out there, but it's been relatively low for a while. As that price increases, obviously that becomes more difficult and more costly for companies. And it also raises issues to do with what's called carbon leakage, which I'm sure we'll come on to, which is what you do about imports of goods from abroad, but which also include CO2 emissions in their production.
Okay, well, let's get into what's going on in the EU then. First of all, can you give us a little history around the ETS? And then we'll get on to, you know, why the carbon price has risen so dramatically in the last 6 to 12 months. But a little bit of a history first, perhaps.
Sure. Well, the ETS was established several years ago. So the EU has been aiming to reduce emissions for a while, and it's currently in its so-called fourth phase. I think it was first set up in 2005. And allowances were originally issued to companies. Now some of them are auctioned. And over time, they've been tightening the number of allowances that are out there with the aim of gradually reducing emissions. And it was the last major reform was a few years ago in order to deal with a buildup of surplus that had occurred because emissions dropped during the financial crisis, because companies were doing less, and that led to a surplus of emissions. And that's the so-called market stability reserve. It is currently undergoing reform again because in order to meet these more strict targets that the EU has set for 2030 and also for 2050. So obviously that is going to have an impact on carbon prices. In terms of the recent increase, I haven't looked at the numbers in the last few days, but basically the EU allowance price, the traded price, has hit sort of around the 50 euros per ton of CO2 mark. And that's ramped up really dramatically in the last year. And part of the reason for that is that people are anticipating the EU policy will be stricter in order to meet these tougher emissions targets, and therefore there'll be fewer allowances around, hence the price goes up. But also the EU has been trying to tighten the number of allowances in circulation already, this market stability reserve. And so that's also had an effect.
Okay, let's come to the market stability reserve in just a second. I think it's important to point out for people that the ETS doesn't cover all sectors, though, does it? I mean, there's a fairly limited number of industries and sectors it covers. Could you talk us a little bit through that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there are two aspects to that. One, as you say, it doesn't cover all sectors. So according to the EU, it covers 40% of the EU's greenhouse gas emissions. Though I have to be honest, I'm not entirely clear if that's the case, because it only covers CO2 and a couple of other things. It doesn't include other greenhouse gases such as methane or hydrofluorocarbon. So I'm not sure what that greenhouse gas figure refers to, but taking their own numbers, that's only 40%, about 10,000 installations. But within that sort of number, and also it does cover aviation, but only in a very limited sense, so only basically flights within countries covered by the ETS, which is the EU plus Norway, Liechtenstein, and Iceland. But even within those sectors that are covered, some of those companies involved, or quite a lot of them, depending on the sector, get free allowances because of the way the mechanism works. So although they're covered by the ETS, they're not actually having to pay a price for their CO2 emissions. And one of the groups that get free allowances quite a lot is aviation. So 85% of allowances for aviation are not auctioned. And for the other, the industrial emitters, 43% aren't auctioned. And the reason they get them for free are because of things like carbon leakage, or because they're assessed to be kind of best in their class in terms of emissions performance.
Okay. And again, for clarity, I think if I read your report correctly, some countries adjust that, don't they? So some countries make carbon prices or carbon taxes apply to a broader range of sectors and industries. Is that correct? So there's a kind of national adjustment, if you like.
Yes, absolutely. And I wouldn't characterize it as an adjustment. I just say it's an additional policy. So a number of countries have got explicit carbon taxes, but they range from, if I'm remembering my report correctly, about 119 euros per ton in Sweden down to less than one in other places. And these are in addition to the ETS. So companies might have to pay that as well, or there could be allowances allowing for the fact that they pay the ETS. And I think this raises an important point is, it's horrendously complicated to work out what the actual carbon price is. There is no single carbon price. And therefore, if you're a company trying to figure out what your exposure is at the EU, it is going to vary country by country and potentially also activity by activity, depending how these things are structured. The overall aim is good that countries have been introducing supplemental carbon taxes, for example, in order to improve their emissions performance. But it does make it messy, put it like that.
Indeed. Okay. Well, let's come back to the main point you made, which is that the price has been rising, and there's a sort of general consensus that as the EU toughens its stance on emissions, the price is likely to continue to rise. And you mentioned the market stability reserve as one, if you like, method of controlling supply of the allocations. Can you talk us a little bit more about the market stability reserve, how it's worked so far, and what the anticipated sort of outlook is?
Effectively, you've got to remember that under an ETS, it's the number of allowances in circulation compared to the demand for allowances, i.e. companies that activity, that set the carbon price. And of course, the aim is that you reduce the amount of allowances over time so that gradually companies emit less and less. The trouble is, you might be able to set the supply, but you don't necessarily have direct control over demand. So what happened about 10 years ago coming out of the financial crisis, as we know, economies were hit hard. That means that the amount of emissions as a result of economic industrial activity dropped. And so what happened was quite a big surplus of allowances built up in the system of sort of over, you know, of a couple of billion or so. And the belief was that this was obviously depressing prices because, you know, there were plenty of allowances sloshing around and demand wasn't soaking them all up. And so, of course, the price, as you'd expect, you know, supply-demand interaction was low. So the EU introduced the MSR and it came into effect a couple of years ago, where basically they calculate how many allowances are in general circulation, almost like the money supply or the allowance supply, as it were, based on total amount of allowances that were out there that had been issued, less demand, and less any that have been put in, that have been put into the market stability reserve. And they calculate this number each year. And based on that number, they then take additional allowances out of circulation and put them into the MSR. And the reason that this has an impact on the number of allowances in circulation and the price is because the allowances that they take out of circulation and put in the MSR reduces the number of allowances that countries, the EU member states, are allowed to auction to companies who need to buy them to cover their emissions. That's the basic bit. There are a couple of kind of bits around it in terms of how much allowances are taken out at any one time. And also, if it's believed that the number of allowances in circulation is going too low, then there's a mechanism whereby some allowances can either the amount put into the MSR is reduced or the amount of allowances can be sort of, you know, put back into circulation. It's quite a complicated sort of thing to explain, so I suggest people read the paper if they want to know it more.
No, that's fine, but I mean the bottom line is you're adjusting the supply of allowances in circulation in order to make sure the price doesn't fall and to compensate for unexpected lower demand, effectively. And, you know, if demand suddenly leapt, you could let some of the allowances back into the market, although that doesn't seem desperately likely. Is that the bottom line?
That is the bottom line. And the EU makes great play of the fact that this is a mechanistic process. In other words, it should be outside of political interference. But guess what? Laws can change. And certainly, you know, as carbon prices rise, I think there could be a lot of discussion as to how the mechanism works. But we will see.
Indeed. OK, well, that's clear. So the other kind of big issue I think that's out there at the moment, of course, and you've mentioned carbon leakage, and we know that there's been the whole question around methane emissions and imports. Is this carbon border adjustment mechanism and avoiding, if you like, disadvantaging European emitters versus emitters who import goods into the EU? Can you just talk us through what the current thinking is on the carbon border adjustment mechanism and what the outlook is?
Sure. Okay. Well, it's important to define carbon leakage first. And this is basically the idea that if you have a high carbon price, whether it be because of the ETS or a carbon tax in the EU, that either EU-based manufacturers will move their production abroad to areas where there's a lower carbon price, or we will instead import goods from outside of Europe, which have a lower carbon price and therefore an overall lower price, instead of buying European production. And either of those harm the EU. They either, you know, harm EU companies directly because they go out of business in Europe, or, you know, we lose jobs, etc. And that's the major concern. To date, this has been dealt with by issuing industries and sectors at risk of carbon leakage with free allowances. So in other words, they still have to use allowances, but they don't have to pay for them. And the list of sectors is quite large, and it ranges everything from plastics and steel and chemicals to interesting little things like milk powder and baker's yeast. I'm not quite sure why those things are included, but I thought it interesting that the scope is so large. The idea of the carbon border adjustment mechanism is that instead of issuing free allowances, you basically put a price on the carbon content of imports in some form or other. And the way that you do that, there are different ways of doing that. But the idea is that you basically level the playing field between people who are subject to the EU carbon pricing mechanisms and to people who are importing goods from outside the EU. Now, this is under development. One of the key problems is that you come up against World Trade Organization rules, which basically say that you can't favor your own production over production elsewhere. You have to treat everybody the same. So the design of the carbon border adjustment mechanism is crucial to make sure that it meets WTO rules. And already at meetings of the WTO, other countries have expressed concerns that this is not so much a carbon pricing policy as an industrial protection policy. And that's basically what all the argument is about. And then the detail is how you kind of reconcile that.
I mean, indeed, you mentioned those discussions. I mean, I know John Kerry has already raised it for the US perspective, and I'm aware that other importers like Russia and other importers of energy are concerned that this is some kind of political policy. Has the EU responded to that? I mean, what's their take on it?
Well, the current situation is that they're consulting on what the exact proposals should look like. And there are two things to bear in mind with the carbon border adjustment mechanism. One is they've said that they will only introduce it where they think that other countries aren't being ambitious enough in their climate targets. So there's obviously scope for some kind of broad multinational agreement in that place. And the other thing is they've said that it will be compatible with WTO rules. The issue with that is obviously the devil is in the detail. Based on stuff that I read a little while ago, the front runner for making sure that things are compatible with WTO rules is that you have some kind of ETS-linked mechanism for imports, which sounds very simple in theory, but in practice there are lots of sort of complications, like how you verify things, how you decide what the carbon footprint of different goods, etc., is. The EU ETS is complicated enough. There are 54 benchmarks for different industrial processes as to what emission levels are, etc. So of course you then have to figure out how you apply that to imports, as well as companies that within your own jurisdiction. So I think there are a lot of hurdles to be overcome to make it work.
And just very briefly, has the EU or do you have any kind of assessment of when we might see a carbon border adjustment mechanism actually implemented?
Well, the proposals are meant to be out by the end of this year, but I think this is one of the more complicated issues. I think it might get subsumed into other international agreements. We've obviously got COP26 at the end of the year. So I'd hesitate to see when we might see one in place, just because I think it's going to be really, really complicated.
Okay, fine. Well, let's move on from that complicated topic to another complicated topic, which is the impact of Brexit. And one of the most sort of standout phrases in your report was your assertion that the inability of the UK and the EU to come up with a common carbon policy was a monumental failure of policy, with the UK leaving the EU ETS. Could you expand a little bit on that and also say what the UK has been doing post-Brexit?
Sure, okay. Well, the reason for saying that is because as a result of Brexit, the UK left the EU ETS. Now, the UK is the second biggest member of the EU ETS in terms of emissions and economic activity. UK was the second biggest economy in Europe. So you are reducing the size of the ETS quite substantially. Now, that's bad in itself. You're reducing the whole point of an ETS is that it has lots of different companies all trading to reach the most efficient carbon price and way of reducing emissions. If you take 10% of it away, which the UK leaving has done, it's not a good thing. Now, the EU has said that they want to, link the ETS, the EU ETS with other ETSs to spread carbon pricing, increase this sort of trading efficiency, etc. And they have said that, the criteria for this are system compatibility, that the systems have the same basic environmental integrity, and a ton of CO2 in one system is a ton in the other system. The mandatory nature of the system and the existence of an absolute cap on emissions. Well, the UK hits all those targets. And we know that the UK is compatible with EU ETS because it was in it. So it doesn't really matter who you blame, whether it's the EU or the UK. Frankly speaking, I think it's both of them and equally bad. But if you can't do it with the UK and come up with some kind of linkage, how easy is it going to be to do, say, a linkage with the forthcoming China ETS? Because any issues you have about sovereignty, for example, if those were the key questions, you're going to have elsewhere. And to give another idea of how sort of absurd it is, you know, the EU has trumpeted that Switzerland has now linked its ETS with the EU. It's the first outside or so-called third country to do this. The trouble is that, put this in context, Switzerland is smaller than London in population terms. So whilst it's fantastic that Switzerland has joined the EU ETS, it really does rather put it in perspective that you've gained something that's so small relative to what you've just lost. So if both the UK and EU are as serious about climate change as they say they are, and they both have net zero targets by 2050, it does beg the question, well, why couldn't they have agreed something on this? It actually shows that politics for other political priorities trumped climate priorities, because otherwise they would have done it.
And so the UK has set up its own ETS. Do you anticipate that ultimately that ETS will be coordinated with the EU ETS? And how do you see the role of other UK energy taxes? Because obviously in the past, the UK has trumpeted its carbon floor and the ability to remove coal from the system. I mean, how do you see that relationship going forward?
Well, I can't really, it's very difficult to figure out the relationship between the UK and EU because of the whole sort of Brexit fallout and everything. It is true that in the agreement between them, the trade agreement between them, which is very limited in many respects, including in this respect, they say they should try and cooperate and all the rest of it, but it's pretty high level and pretty vague. So when it will happen, I don't know. UK industry prior to Brexit were asking for the two schemes to be linked. That hasn't happened. In terms of going forward, the UK is setting up a system which is, you know, remarkably similar to the one that it left. So I think there should be scope for linkage in the future. The UK also has an adjustment mechanism similar to the market stability mechanism that we talked about earlier for the EU. The UK also has quite a good track record in terms of carbon pricing making an impact because a few years ago, it introduced a carbon floor price. Because the EU ETS price was so low, it wasn't having as big an impact as was hoped. And so the UK introduced a carbon floor price in power generation, which basically meant that power generators had to pay an additional carbon tax, as it were, on top of the EU ETS price. And over the last few years, this has pretty much eliminated coal from the UK energy mix. And the interesting comparison is with Germany, which didn't take that approach, but has spent a lot of money on renewables. Well, in Germany, you still have coal as a substantial part of the power generation mix. And the result is that Germany's carbon footprint per kilowatt hour of electricity is about a third higher between a third and a half higher than the UK carbon footprint. So that actually just goes to show how, get the carbon price right, you can have quite a big impact. We shall see how the UK evolves.
So let's move on as we get sort of towards the end of our podcast to talk about, you know, the future. And you mentioned, you know, get the carbon price right and emissions will sort themselves out. So despite the fact the price has risen sharply over the last 12 months, is it high enough yet? What kind of levels should we be looking for? For example, I don't know, relative to the IEA sustainable development scenario assumptions, where do you think we need to be heading and can we get there?
Sure. Well, I must admit, it's very difficult to do the numbers in terms of saying what is right for the EU. But if you compare with the IEA SDS scenario, they say that to get the world on track, and this is a world number, you'd need a carbon price in developed countries, such as the EU and the UK, of 56 euros per ton or 46 pounds per ton by 2025. Now, as we've seen, the EU is getting close to that now. But it very much depends on whether people continue to think that those policies are credible. you know, if they think they're not credible, then obviously the price of future allowances you'd expect to fall. And by 2040, the IEA reckons that you need a carbon price in developed countries of 112 euros per ton or 95 pounds per ton by 2040. So you can see that there's a little way to go compared to now, but that assumes that, you know, the policies actually support the recent price increase, and quite a way to go by 2040. And of course, the higher the price rises, particularly relative to other things, the more sensitive people will become about issues like carbon leakage and hence the carbon border adjustment mechanism.
And I guess the other issue is that the price is the one thing, but then it's the scope of the companies actually having to pay that price. And so do you foresee the percentage of sectors and industries needing to pay the carbon tax expanding as well?
That's something that the EU is currently consulting on, and it will be, you know, they're consulting on a couple of things. One is reducing the amount of allowances, and so that would imply, you know, less free allowances being given out, and they have said they want to give less free allowances out. If a carbon border adjustment mechanism is introduced, then in theory you shouldn't have free allowances given for carbon leakage. They've talked about, you know, they've waiting to see what happens as a result of the aviation industry's CORSA initiative on carbon pricing for aviation, depending on what they do with allowances for that. And as you say, there is potential for expanding the scope beyond the current sort of 40% of emissions currently covered, because the other 60% is covered by countries' own commitments under the EU effort sharing regulation framework to reduce emissions. But clearly, the bigger the pool, as it were, of carbon pricing within the ETS, hopefully the more efficient the actual result will be.
Okay, and I think the other issue I'd just like to touch on is, and you've mentioned the Chinese ETS, and you've mentioned the fact that the IEA, you know, Sustainable Development Scenario, is obviously looking at a global carbon price. What can you say about the potential for other ETS schemes or other carbon prices emerging and them being linked with each other and with the EU ETS?
Well, this would be a huge win, because the IEA has got a huge range for carbon abatement across the world, some of them being negative, like as a result of, you know, better energy efficiency. But of course, they're in different places. So if you could link ETSs across different countries, you could potentially get a lot of sort of, you know, low-hanging fruit and wins from that. The trouble would be, how would you govern it? Because you'd have to make sure that everybody's ETS scheme was suitably robust. You'd have to make sure that everybody's ETS scheme didn't just print extra allowances when things were getting tough or to favour their local industry. So I think it actually could be incredibly difficult. And then you have the governance mechanism, you know, which I suspect was one of the problems with why the UK and the EU couldn't agree on continuing the ETS between them. So there's a big, big win out there because of this big range of abatement costs, but whether it can be achieved, and we know that multilateral agreements, you know, look at the Paris Agreement, et cetera, are very difficult to achieve.
Okay, well, look, we're coming right to the end of our time. So, you know, thanks very much indeed for the discussion today. I guess one final point before we go, your paper, which I'll just say the title again, The Challenges and Prospects for Carbon Pricing in Europe, was, if you like, something of a foundation paper for the Institute on carbon. What are your plans, just briefly, for the sort of next steps of the research?
Well, I think in terms of next steps, it's looking at the detail of the carbon border adjustment mechanism. It would be looking at the detail of the ETS, because you know, we've kind of kept it quite a high level here. And where, if people go and read the report, you'll see that there is an awful lot of so-called devil in the detail, and the same will be true of future prospects. There's also the issue of what happens with natural gas. So, for example, methane is not included in the ETS. I've read that it's not going to be part of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, but it's a whole separate work stream, and it is, you know, greenhouse gas related. I think the other big thing to recognize is that how you share the burdens of this, because carbon taxes will tend to be regressive in the sense they will tend to hit poorer people more or poorer countries more, because you have to have a certain amount of energy just to exist. And so how you manage that issue in a way that gets everybody to sign up to the targets, etc., I think is going to be another sort of key area.
Okay, great. Well, look, thank you very much indeed again for the discussion today, which has been absolutely fascinating. Please do go and look for the paper on our website, and look out also for future editions of the OIES Energy Podcast. But with that, thank you very much for listening. Stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.